Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with the Kia Dealers of Ireland. Our showrooms are open for business with your health and safety our priority. For more, log on to kia.com.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and a very welcome to Liveline. Joe at RT.ie is the email from anywhere in the world. Samantha Power is a leading global voice on human rights and international affairs. She served, as many of us in Ireland know, because of her very strong Irish connections, she served for 4 years as President Barack Obama's human rights advisor, and then from 2013 to 2017 in his cabinet and as US ambassador to the United Nations. She's an author, broadcaster, and currently professor of practice at Harvard Law School and the Harvard Kennedy School. Samantha Power, good afternoon. I know it's morning where you are, and I appreciate you joining us. Samantha Power, good afternoon from Ireland, where you, in your recent book, The Education of an Idealist. Samantha, you wrote a lot about your growing up in Ireland and with your mother and your father, of course. So you've incredibly strong connections here. Both your parents are Irish. Samantha, in the 10 days that have shook America since George Floyd was killed on the street, has anything, especially about the actions of the president, has anything surprised you given what we've been through for the last 3 years?
Thanks, and great to be with you, Joe. You know, after 3.5 years of Trump being in many ways exactly who he said he was going to be in the campaign and exactly who he has been previewing he would be on issues related to race and equality, you know, for much of his life, it's hard to be shocked or surprised by his cruelty and his coldness and seeming indifference to the pain of so many Americans. But I think what is shocking is the extent to which the Republicans in the Senate, you know, who have made it clear that now the Republican Party is the party of Trump. I mean, again, that shouldn't be surprising, I suppose, but that there are no lines, that there are no limits, that even attempting to dispatch tanks in the streets of America to pit us against one another, to sow division, to put our military in impossible positions, unconstitutional positions, that there are no lines, it seems, and that they will remain quiet and that they will not raise their voices, even in circumstances like the ones you see being played out on your television screens and on your Twitter feeds. I think that, you know, there was always just a hope that the principles that they would have espoused, certainly if this were Barack Obama in office and events like this were transpiring, or if Obama were sowing division, but also the principles that they would have espoused before the party became the party of Trump. I think that quietude, that bystanding, that willingness to be silent and in many ways complicit with whatever the president is doing to stir racism and to try to incite violence, it seems, the fact that that is not being vocally contested by people in his own party is shocking.
It is being vocally contested by former staffers. Jim Mattis, retired general, former defense secretary, Castig, what did he say? Trump was an immature president making a mockery of the Constitution. Now, the problem is, Samantha, every time people of stature speak out against Trump, he just replied, what did he say about Jim Mattis? Oh, he's the most overrated. It's all personal, most overrated general. I sacked him. Obama sacked him. He launches personalized attacks on these individuals. Well, what does that tell us about the man, the president?
Well, I think your question speaks for itself. I mean, it's all ad hominem, but it's also, I mean, critically, this is a lot of this is diversion. You know, I mean, because of the collapse of jobs and the fact that 40 million Americans, you know, have sought unemployment benefits, Trump has lost his one, the sort of foundation for his reelection campaign because he so grossly mishandled the COVID pandemic from the earliest stages to the present. You know, he's looked to blame China. He's looked to blame the WHO. He's now this breaks out, you know, in some ways part of the way I think his mind works from people who work closely with him is it's almost an opportunity to make people forget about the pandemic and the mishandling of the pandemic and the economy. And you know, his strategy for seeking re-election is, as you say, to disparage those who disagree with them and to attack their personal character and all of that. We know that. But it's also, you know, very sort of explicitly about getting the 40% of the country that stands with him virtually no matter what to be more activated than they might have otherwise been, and to try to drive down the vote in other communities, for example, communities of color, through legal means of trying to actually put in place, you know, for lack of a better expression, voter suppression measures, you know, through Republican-controlled state legislatures around the country. That's been afoot. Voter ID laws, really restrictive voter ID laws, so that students and people of color have a harder time voting. But that's on the suppression side. On the motivation side, an event like this, you know, part of him is thinking this is you know, will motivate people more and more. And on Fox News and in these right wing echo chambers, you know, what they're seeing is very different than what you and I are seeing. They're seeing really only images of looting, you know, images that are construed as being very presidential, like holding up a Bible and striding bravely across a square that they don't mention has just been, you know, tear gassed, and where clergy and others have been, you know, pushed down and beaten. None of that is mentioned in the media platforms that are watched by those who Trump is counting on to lead the charge.
And we've had animated debate since Monday, including people who contacted us with Irish connections from the States who will be incredibly strong supporters, evangelical supporters of Donald Trump, and they don't watch CNN, and they do get all their information from Fox. And when you say to them, oh, what do you think of the march to the St. John's Church and clearing the crowds beforehand with tear gas, they'll deny, which I think Trump does as well, they'll deny it was tear gas, even though I think both the Washington Post and the New York Times have established that there was tear gas used. So the minute you say anything, you're just the retort is fake news. That's not true. That's not true. That's not true. How do you, like, where is all of this going to end?
I hope it will end with the defeat of this president in November by Joe Biden, who's been acting as presidential as one would have wished, and you know, we'll be doing and saying more and more as conditions hopefully begin to open up, and Biden can do what Biden is famous for, which is to be out there really engaging in a very intimate, you know, and concerned and empathetic way. I mean, the contrast between Biden's kind of inherent regard for dignity and equality. I mean, again, nobody's perfect, but the fact that throughout his career, he has tried to live by what he says his dad taught him when he was young, which is, Joey, you're better than nobody, but nobody's better than you. Mm-hmm. And that kind of core sense that both in terms of working class people who've turned away from the Democratic Party and in terms of African Americans who have not been able to secure equal justice under the law, he can speak to those people, and he has, but again, in this remote way, it makes it more challenging. So he will be out there. I think that what I said at the outset, that Republicans in the U.S. Senate and in the House of Representatives, they're worried about their voting prospects as well. The U.S. Senate looked like a shoe-in for the Republicans to retain, which is critical, of course, for them to block Joe Biden from doing a set of things that he would wish to do if he becomes president. That map for them is looking much, much worse. Every day Trump is in office, the prospects of the Democrats taking the Senate grow greater. The map is much wider. Maine and Arizona and states that were not seen to be in play just 3 months ago are now, you know, you see Democrats with significant leads. And so maybe self-interest, always a good thing to try to tap in a politician, I guess. Maybe that will cause there to be more pushback in the Republican Party. I do think what Mattis did was significant. particularly for the officer corps within the U.S. military and the rank and file. He's a beloved figure, and it has been noteworthy and frankly frustrating that since he left office, he has muted himself and not spoken out publicly. He's been very reserved and in many ways respectful of the office of commander in chief, and that had been his plan, was to stay quiet. So you will see, again, more figures, I think, of that stature. Mike Mullen, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, also came out a couple days ago and just said, I can't stay silent. He is also somebody who had not raised his voice, believing that propriety and tradition meant kind of closing ranks behind whoever the commander in chief was. But the dam is bursting, and it's almost a battle between two clocks, an electoral clock that is driving toward November and the opportunity voters will have. Notwithstanding the 40% that stays with Trump, you can't win the presidential election with 40%, especially in the swing states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, now Arizona, and places like that. So you have the electoral clock, but then you have the clock of current events and how much worse the situation is deteriorating every day.
And that, can we focus on that for a minute, Samantha? Because since Liveline's a phone-in program, we have listeners in America through the internet. They've dominated the program this week, and I ask every one of them, will this phase end or fizzle out? I think is that Irish word I used, or will the violence and the protests continue? And to a man and a woman, they all said they think it will not fizzle out. That these protests will continue and the reaction of Donald Trump will continue and the threats of dominating the streets with the army will continue. So will this end in more bloodshed?
If it's left to Trump, I don't think there's any question that it's going to continue to deteriorate because his plan, as you know, is to invoke this piece of legislation that most people hadn't studied until this week, the Insurrection Act from the early 19th century. We still have institutions. We see the most grotesque attacks on journalists, violent attacks on journalists, arrests of journalists.
100 of them over one weekend in the States.
Indeed. Yet the journalists keep reporting and they keep digging into questions like, was it tear gas? And questions, again, you never thought that you would see the American press having to dig into in 2020. But nonetheless, the press is doing its job. The Democrats, because they turned out in record numbers in 2018, control the House of Representatives, which is a lever. If the Insurrection Act is invoked, that is going to be litigated very quickly. I'm sure the American Civil Liberties Union and others already have their briefs written, knowing that that is in play. And the fact that not just we've talked about Mattis and Admiral Mullen, who retired senior military officers who command tremendous respect across America, but the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the head of our armed forces, himself taking this exceptional step of writing to officers and to rank and file soldiers and saying, your duty is to the Constitution, to the rule of law. We are the most diverse, one of the most diverse institutions in the history of the world, the U.S. Armed Forces, and we pride ourselves on pursuing equality and obeying the rule of law, respecting the rights of peaceful protest and citizens. I mean, that is the general who is sitting at the right hand of Trump. So there is a ton of pushback. I just think there's one man, as it were, with his finger on the button, and we can't get away from that, which is why elections matter.
And we presume it was Donald Trump, President Trump himself, who decided to march, to clear the streets, what everyone tells us was a peaceful protest, to clear the streets violently, and so he could walk from the White House across Lafayette Park to St. John's Church and stand there with a Bible. But in his entourage, there were men in military uniform of high rank.
Indeed. As a friend of mine tweeted, I think yesterday, it's a truly successful photo op when everybody involved in the photo op, apart from the principal, the president, spends the next 48 hours disavowing their participation. I mean, every single person pictured in that photo op has some alibi for why they ended up there. They were doing one thing and the other thing.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not, notwithstanding, as you rightly point out, the vehemence of people who are getting one side of the story and only seeing the violence and the looting, which is occurring, you know, in major American cities, but really is a minority of the protesters who are trying to, who are kneeling and who are singing "Lean on Me" and who are, you know, it is by and large a peaceful protest movement rooted in years of pain and fear and exhaustion, and notwithstanding that 40%, or it's probably less than that even at this point.
Okay.
There is a ton of pushback that is happening. The problem is, as Trump gets more and more desperate, and every poll, you know, some people like me who are Democrats, and they see the latest poll numbers from swing states that put Biden, let's say, a few points ahead, many Democrats relish those polls. I wish they would come out months from now, you know, because every poll that Trump sees turns him into some kind, not just a Twitter frenzy, but it makes him look to lash out. And so his own personal vulnerability, because of the economy, because of COVID, because of these polls, is part of the story here as to why he is fomenting this. But it also lies, again, in who he is. People say that, you know, a man or a woman tell you who they are within the first 15 minutes of meeting them. Donald Trump has not hidden from us where his sympathies would lie in a circumstance like this.
Every living former American president, including your mentor, friend, and employer, Barack Obama, have spoken out against what Trump is doing, especially in the last few days. Donald Trump, the current president, doing in the last few days. But is there any historical figure, Samantha Power, that you would find resonance in Donald Trump? Is there any precedent for this?
Well, I mean, as others have noted, I think it's like having Joe McCarthy or George Wallace or Bull Connor as your president. I mean, there are plenty of populist, nationalistic, xenophobic leaders, but who've never achieved a position of such prominence on the American stage. I mean, that's the tragedy here, and who have succeeded. And this is, you know, the sort of easy to underestimate political genius of Donald Trump, but who have succeeded in creating this devil's bargain with other Republicans who I think don't share his worldview, particularly on whether America is a nation of immigrants and whether diversity and inclusion are strong suits. This level of you know, exclusivity and the Republican Party being the party only of one ethnicity or one religion. I mean, this is very distinct to Trump, but he has done a bargain and said, I will get you the kind of judges that you want. I will get you the kind of tax cuts that you want. Okay. And the price of that is that I will be myself and you will stay silent.
And internationally, is there a historical figure that you've compared him to, live or dead?
Well, there's a lot of competition these days in Hungary Russia, and even as President Xi consolidates power, but also does so by stirring such virulent nationalism in China. Even President Xi, I think, look to any authoritarian figure in history, and there will be parallels.
And what that means, Samantha, which is an incredible question for me ever to ask anybody, especially someone who's been so close to the reins of power in the United States, has any American president ever been, has ever generated a question such as, Samantha, do you think this will, do you think he will give up power if he's defeated? Do you think he'll give up? Do you think he will go without a fight? Now, that is a question you would ask about Russia or China or Syria, and you'd never think you'd ever ask it about the United States. But what we're seeing from here, and the impression we're getting from here, is of someone who is deranged.
Well,
I know you're not laughing, but it's not funny because he's the most, because he has his finger
no,
on
I,
he
has I, his finger. Nothing funny.
I know, but he has his finger, as you say, on the button.
Yeah, there's nothing funny. You're absolutely right. It's devastating, and it's immensely painful to see a country that 3.5 years ago was run by, you know, somebody of great decency, didn't make all the right calls, he'd be the first to admit, but that we could go again from someone who tried to bring us together and try to heal some of these divisions that are so longstanding to this is it's heartbreaking. There are no words really to describe. However, I think the reason that your question is a legitimate question is severalfold. First, Trump himself, prior to the last election, refused to say that he would respect and recognize the result. He lost. So this is prior to the 2016 election. He has had multiple bills, pieces of legislation sent to him to protect our election infrastructure, which we know was penetrated by the Russian Federation. And he has refused to put in place protection of that infrastructure. He is working with massive financial advantage because of the power of incumbency and because of the big tax breaks he's offered so many. He has huge financial coffers to draw upon to be, again, investing in these voter disenfranchisement efforts across the country, which is not exactly in the spirit of, you know, let all the votes be counted. It's about really trying to dictate who gets to show up. So he's not blocking foreign interference or even admitting that it occurred in 2016. And voter disenfranchisement, as he gets more and more alarmed at his own flagging poll ratings, is a tactic he's pursuing with great resources behind it right now. So you have reason to worry. However, we do have courts. And yes, they have been filled by Trump-appointed judges. And yes, the Supreme Court should right now be a 5-4 majority with a Supreme Court justice named Merrick Garland seated on that court. But for the utterly exceptional actions by Senate Republicans to just allow the seat to stay vacant in the hopes that they would win the election. So they do. The Republican appointed judges have a 5-4 majority on the Supreme Court. But it is not as if the Supreme Court, you know, just willy-nilly is necessarily going to ignore the rule of law, ignore the Constitution, nor is it the case that the Secret Service or the U.S. military. We saw General Chairman Milley's letter on current events. But imagine flash forward to if Trump does try to hang on.
And he would say, as he's creating the atmosphere now, the postal ballots are rife for corruption. This is his current trope.
No, he has. I should have mentioned that. Yes, he's laying the predicate for this is what he did before the 2016 election as well. He's laying the predicate to be able to claim fraud on the back end, I'm sure, to leave his options open, to be able to give himself, an excuse for remaining in office. But what I'm saying to you is that notwithstanding Trump's inordinate power, as any Democratic leader has far more power than anyone else in a democratic society, American institutions have bent and they have been bent by the president, but they have not yet broken. And I think you would expect enormous pushback in the face, including by Republicans, even including by those Republicans who have been silent so far as Trump seeks to militarize the response to these protests. Will not. I would not leave it up to my point. Is just we should not leave the question of whether he departs. That question is not one that resides only in the mind and the intentions of President Trump.
Okay. Just to give you another glimpse, Samantha, of what's happening this side of the pond, so to speak. I don't know whether you know Piers Morgan. He was a TV host in the States, former editor, disgraced at various times, but he now presents a morning talk show here in the UK. We get it here in Ireland. And there was an extraordinary exchange this morning between Rudy Giuliani, who they admit they used to be friends, and Piers used to get to nab all the saccharine interviews with Trump because they were buddies. But Piers Morgan has now turned against Trump over COVID and over. But this just to give you a glimpse, Samantha, of the language that's been used and the response. This is Piers Morgan and Rudy Giuliani going at it, as Seamus Heaney would say, hammer and tongs this morning on UK television.
And you are helping to create violence in this country with the way you're covering this.
When I used to interview you, you were an intelligent, reasonable man. and you've gone completely mad, and you sound deranged. You're abusive.
Saying that because I and don't it's really, think you're
it's really
married.
Sad to see what's happened to you. I had the stomach to stand up and say that your gun culture is completely out of control and unacceptable. And people like you kept telling me, don't be ridiculous. We're entitled to go on shooting each other all day long.
Now so you're lying again.
I will stand by what I did.
A quote from me about your stupid comment.
Rudy Giuliani, as you know, was one of the former spokes defenders in every sense of the word of Donald Trump. But just there's Piers Morgan calling him deranged, bonkers. That's the level of discourse at this stage. Does that have any resonance? Does people say this is going mad rather than bad politics? This is mad politics.
I mean the recording speaks for itself, and it's reflective, as you say, of a breakdown and just such a virulent partyism, you know, a political polarization, and the fact that we don't have a shared factual evidentiary baseline. Mm-hmm. From which we can argue. So part, I heard the full interview, okay. I think, and I mean, part of it is early this morning, but part of it is just, they're just yelling. It's almost like school kids, but pre-social school kids who are saying, no, this happened. Yeah. No, well, you know, you're the dog ate my homework. No, your mother's, you know, ugly. And I mean, it's gotten to that level, but there's no shared baseline from which then you can deliberate over what the right thing to do is. And that's the problem in this country is Trump is telling you it's all about looters who you know, need to be cracked down on with the military, irrespective of the fact that that bears very little resemblance to what's actually playing out in American streets. And you know, in our country, we actually have fewer scenes like the one that you've just played, in part because of our media echo chambers, in part because Fox News wouldn't have on people who were going to challenge President Trump's narrative and account of what's happening. God forbid that slip in to the media diet of people who are listening to Fox News. So, but it is. It's been reduced to name calling. You know, in some ways, I feel like Trump's Twitter feed with all of its all caps and its exclamations, it's a metaphor almost for what the discourse has become. Everything is in all caps. Everything has exclamation marks next to it. Name calling is at the heart of discourse, but it has to change. We can't go on. I mean, I gave you an account of how this can end, you know, and how this can be diffused. I mean, because it can't come from Trump, it will have to come from governors and mayors mm-hmm. and others who are showing strength and largeness of a kind that Trump is incapable of, but it also has to end through elections. It can't only be about protest. It has to be, these protests have to turn into voter registration drives, in order to end it. But even when it ends, Trumpism doesn't die when President Trump is no longer president, and our media echo chambers don't suddenly become pluralistic venues for fact-based discourse and debate. That has to come from other actors in our society. And so we have so much digging out to do on the back side of this, so much reaching out to do also for those within the Trump camp who somehow still can be reached, you know, who may like one strand of what Trump is offering, like his, you know, giving the finger to the elites. They might like that, but they may not like the whole you know, bundle of other qualities that he brings, including, again, this playing on race and pitting us against one another. So there just is a huge amount of healing that has to be done, including, of course, the healing that is needed on racial grounds, which is what has sparked this particular chapter in the Trump presidency in the first place.
Samantha, can you stay with us for a few more minutes? Because I'd love to talk to you even briefly about your book and your Irish connection. I want to try and find out what your mother, Vera, is doing, because I know she's a senior medic. I was asking you there about you write about your mother and indeed your late father in your memoir, so to speak. Samantha, how is your mother?
Thank you so much for asking. My mother is a physician, as I've written.
Vera Delaney, as you'd be known.
Vera Delaney from County Cork, UCC grad, and then worked at the Mead Hospital there in Dublin, yeah, and came to America in 1979 with me at age 9. She is, amazingly, she's 76, but she's working at Mount Sinai Hospital, wow, putting on the PPE, as one does, working in hospitals these days. So she's one of the amazing figures in both of our countries who are out there on the front lines trying to care for people, notwithstanding the risks that all medical professionals now face. I would say I just talked to her this morning before I came on your program. She was on her way into work, and yesterday or the day before, all the physicians and nurses from Mount Sinai, where she works, mm-hmm, came out to the streets, and there was this dual celebration where the doctors and nurses and hospital staff were cheering the protesters who were clogging, mm-hmm, the streets. Of course, most of the protesters wearing masks, but not all, unfortunately, which is a worry to all, mm-hmm, citizens as well as health professionals. But then the protesters who were protesting Black Lives Matter and protesting Trump's response to the George Floyd killing, they then, in turn, began to celebrate the health workers and the hospital staff, okay, and others who are on the front lines. And so she's at the heart of that, again, very, very troubled, as the rest of
and
us
her,
are.
And her specialty is urology, isn't it? Kidney issues.
Kidneys, yeah, nephrology,
she's,
yes.
She's been long-time specialist in that. You mentioned the protesters, and some of the protesters, unfortunately, not wearing masks, which is an issue that's come up here over the last few days, Samantha. There was a significant demonstration here in Dublin. It was called, on Monday, Black Lives Matter. It was basically organised on social media. Monday here was a bank holiday here in Ireland. And the turnout was close to 5,000 people, which in terms of previous demonstrations of these issues was very surprising in terms of numbers. A lot of people then rode in and said they weren't social distancing, they weren't wearing masks. And then we spoke about it in this programme. But the reaction we got as to why the demonstration was so big and so unforeseen in many ways on Monday was that a lot of the people who marched were Irish people of colour. And they said, we have now come to an age, and a lot of them were on the programme yesterday, in their 20s, where they are sick, sore and tired of the racism that they endured in Ireland. Now, that's a big change from the Ireland that you left. And when you write in your memoir about your dad having his own chair in it's a Hartigan's pub up there,
Hartigan's,
yeah, and you used to sit there with your Club Orange and your packet of crisps or whatever, and I'm imagining that pub. There was never a person of colour in Dublin, see, apart from Philip Linnett or whatever. And the Ireland has changed. Now, I know you've been back and forward, and you did Who Do You Think You Are, and you got married here, and you've been on speaking tours here, but would it surprise you to hear that a lot of people in Ireland, especially of colour, think Ireland is racist?
Well, I would note also that I think Taoiseach spoke to that this morning, even as he was decrying the absence of moral leadership in America. He also probably knows of what he speaks, given his own personal story, but spoke to the need to do far more in Ireland. I mean, everything about modern Ireland is in a way a surprise to somebody who left at age 9 in 1970. I mean, the fact that Ireland would be the first country through popular referendum to embrace same-sex marriage, you know, leading the world on that matter, the fact that Ireland is now at least at a rhetorical level, and I'll get to the core question in a second, but embracing what we call here in America e pluribus unum, you know, in the many we are one, but embracing being a country not of emigrants, but of immigrants in a way that now the United States of America is not. I mean, you have the President of the United States disavowing the Statue of Liberty and the words that are emblazoned on it. But, you know, for all of that progress and for all of the diversity, transitions come hard. And often the kind of private pain that people are harboring in order to fit in, the kind of bullying that they've endured, or the dislocation that traditional Ireland, rural Ireland, depending on, you know, again, where the incidents are, where the melding has gone on, you know, that is, it would be again, very unusual if a country just could transform itself demographically overnight without the kind of systemic racism that we in the United States, we've been at the mixing for a long time, and look at the structural racism that exists at the heart of our nation. So I think if it surfaces, if what's happening in the United States can trigger a conversation, can cause people almost like the Me Too movement to come out and make more visible what has been harbored privately in an interest to fit in or what has been spoken about but just not dealt with at an institutional level or at a social level, then maybe that can be a positive that comes out of it. But there's no question. I mean, I know, in the places that I've traveled in Ireland and just, again, to see the speed of the transformation, you can get lulled into a false sense of complacency in seeing that. And it's really important to dig in to doing, making sure that far more is in place institutionally and culturally to make people feel truly welcome and truly Irish.
Okay. Do you think, Samantha, by the way, we will be hearing a lot more from President Barack Obama between now and November than we had, or even he had predicted, because of what's happened in the last 10 days?
I don't know. I think that you will be hearing an awful lot from Joe Biden, and you will soon be hearing an awful lot from Barack Obama about Joe Biden. There's one leader of the Democratic Party now. Certainly, I think the fact that President Obama spoke yesterday speaks to just, I'm sure, how intolerable it is for him to stay silent, just as it's intolerable for George W. Bush and Jimmy Carter and any other living president, but especially for Barack Obama, who really tried, to bring about meaningful police reform and tried to make young African-American men feel seen and heard, and tried to put in place, policies that would change this, again, structural racism that plays itself out pretty much. I mean, again, the thing to remember about George Floyd and all of the names we know is, by and large, those are the incidents that are caught on camera. And while cameras are ubiquitous in our respective societies, it is just simply not the case that we are capturing even a fraction of the abuses that are carried out against African Americans on a routine basis. And so Barack Obama has lived that, as an African American man in this country. So I think you will hear from him. But I think he is very sensitive to the fact that Joe Biden is the leader of the Democratic Party, and Joe Biden is the person that we all, whose voice we need to get used to hearing at moments like this, because he's the person that we need to, as he says, to restore the soul of the nation.
Okay. And we're seeing it already on the texts here and Twitter feeds and everything that comes into us. Which we had on the program the other day, Samantha. Barack Obama was 8 years in the White House. What did he do to quell racism? So it's all of that kickback would always be there. I don't know where it leads us in terms of debate. And I know, Samantha, it's your disposition and your knowledge. When I say, are you optimistic for the future? I mean, the short term future of the United States of America. I think you would say yes, because of all the checks and balances and the various complexities of the incredible constitution and governance and the architecture of governance in the United States of America. But have you any doubts that this will end peacefully?
Of course, absolutely. You have to, because as we've talked about, you have the president of the United States with unparalleled power compared to any other citizen of the United States, and he's not somebody who sees it as in his personal self-interest to heal the divides that he widens every single day that he's in office. So as I said, I think it is two clocks competing with one another, which is, hopefully our institutions will bend but not break between now and January 20th, 2021. But you can't, and I say this as somebody who did not think that President Trump could appeal to enough Americans to win the presidency. I say this as somebody who was blindsided, so many in this country who got it wrong before. So I think those of us who were shocked by Trump's success among Republicans in the primary to even get the nomination back in 2016, who, as I write in Education of an Idealist, who had election parties thinking that we would be coronating the first female president. We've got a lot of humility now about predicting the future. It is, you know, it is definitely not wise to bet against American citizen action. I think history shows us that. But it is also necessary to be part of the checks and balances oneself. And that's why elections and voting and offsetting this voter disenfranchisement effort that President Trump and others are making, that's the most along with protests. It's important to protest. But as Obama said yesterday, it is about getting to the polls and voting with our feet.
And finally, Samantha, is there any point, like there have been calls here by politicians and MEPs, some, that, what's that phrase people use? Oh, kick out the American ambassador. Our Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney, should call in the American ambassador. Already we've had, this is over 2 weeks ago, our Minister for Health, Simon Harris, when Donald Trump was, and he's now done it, threatening to leave the World Health Organization, our government minister, a cabinet minister here, tweeted that this was petty politics, irresponsible, especially at this time, which you never would have heard before, an Irish senior politician criticizing. Does it make any difference if the American ambassador is asked to leave or is chastised in Stephen's Green by Simon Coveney? Does that make any difference?
I think part of Trump's narrative is that he can do what he wants at home, and because strength and military power and economic power are all that matters, people, our allies, our friends will be with us no matter what. So we can treat our allies badly. We can pull out of major international organizations, including the only global health organization we have at the height of a global pandemic. He himself can foment division and even appear to be calling for shooting and violence, and that our friends will always be with us because we're America and we're strong. I think the actions that our closest friends take, mm-hmm. including the protests that you mentioned already, the overwhelming numerous the size of the protest in Dublin got a lot of attention here in the United States. I think the statements of leaders like Justin Trudeau, the Taoiseach, of Angela Merkel. I mean, these are getting a lot of attention here. Whether they reach a Trump diehard supporter is not, you know, don't look only at that. Think of those Republican senators,
okay,
like Marco Rubio and others who really, you know, who believe in alliances.
Okay. Well, it was Justin Trudeau's 22 seconds of silence that spoke volumes, wasn't it? When he was asked, he just stood there silent. And I think that said more than most. Samantha Parr, thank you so much for your time today in your very busy schedule. Kind regards to you and your family, especially to Vera Delaney. I see people who remember her here in Ireland wishing her well and in disbelief, because they remember when she was a senior clinician here in nephrology, as you say, but they can't believe she's still working at 77. And they just wonder, pointed that she's 4 years older than Donald Trump, and she's thriving. So kind regards to your mother when you're speaking to her this evening. But Samantha Power, former US ambassador to the UN, I really appreciate your time. And people will, Samantha, you go about your ward now and your work and your academic work and your political work and your family work. And I'll sit here now for the next half hour, Samantha, to hear everyone accuse me of being pro-Trump and using phrases like deranged. But I'll sit here like a sponge, like a piñata at a children's Christmas party, children's birthday party. So kind regards, Samantha. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye-bye.